The Guardian.
Hello, welcome to Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha.
You find them in the regenerative brakes of hybrid cars. You find them in these miniaturized motors because they are so extraordinarily, magically strong.
Ahead of his Royal Institution lecture, chemist Professor Andrea Sella gives us a concentrated look at our discovery of and dependency on rare earth metals.
And I shall just finish by answering a couple of questions which I'm sure will be coming my way anyway. Yes, I do play the guitar, but very badly. And I wouldn't inflict my singing on anybody.
And from rare earths to something very rare on this earth. A British astronaut, Major Tim Peake, was unveiled as the first official British astronaut to be selected for a mission to the International Space Station last week. I'll be joined by Guardian science correspondent Ian Sample and Observer science editor Robin McKee to discuss the unveiling and what this means for the British in space. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Major Tim Peake was born in 1972 in Chichester in Sussex. This week, he no doubt made the people of Sussex, and the UK for that matter, extremely proud when he was announced as the first British citizen to make it all the way through the European Space Agency's intensive training camp. He'll be on his way to the International Space Station in 2015. It's a momentous event. And before I discuss this with my Guardian colleagues, here's Major Tim's reaction to the news this week.
Well, I don't think I need to tell you that I'm absolutely delighted with this decision. It was an honour to be selected in 2009 as an astronaut into the European astronaut candidate as a British citizen. But it really is a true privilege to be assigned to a long-duration mission to the International Space Station. For me, it feels like the highlight and the real high point of a long career in aviation. 18 years in the British Army as a pilot, an instructor pilot, and then a test pilot. And then since then, working in civilian industry as a test pilot, and for the last 4 years with the European Space Agency training as an astronaut. And this really is the culmination of all of that. And I'm truly grateful to my friends, family, and my professional colleagues who have provided all the training and support to prepare me for the challenge that lies ahead. And I really will be embracing the challenge over the next 2.5 years to prepare for this mission. I think that the mission to the International Space Station is going to be a wonderful opportunity, not just for Europe and European science, but also in particular for the UK and for UK science and education and for industry as well. And I really hope that we will do everything we can to make the most of this fantastic opportunity. And I shall just finish by answering a couple of questions which I'm sure will be coming my way anyway. Yes, I do play the guitar, but very badly. And I wouldn't inflict my singing on anybody.
So ground control to Major Tim. Did you like that, guys?
No one ever thought of that.
I'm a week late to this, sorry. Anyway, Ian Sample, the Guardian science correspondent, and Robin McKee, the Observer's science editor, are both here to discuss this momentous time and talk a bit about Britain in space, something we've discussed lots before because we love it. And this is great news, isn't it, guys? Robin, why has it taken so long for Britain to get an astronaut into space?
Very, very good question. Lack of will, lack of money, lack of political direction. We are very good at space, and it's only been relatively recently that we've discovered how good we are and how much money it brings to the national economy. Companies you think of like Surrey Satellites have been an immense success. But until now, we've really just thought, well, we don't want it. What's the point of putting men and women in space? Which is actually a very good question, but perhaps a slightly separate one. There's definitely a prestige element of putting a citizen of your country into orbit. And in the end, we've kind of succumbed to it by a very, very long, laborious route. Helen Sharman was our first UK astronaut. Basically, the Russians virtually offered us a free flight, but there's a few millions extra that were needed to put her there. The British government wouldn't even cough up that. And it had to be raised privately. That's the kind of shoestring way we've approached it.
We have had two Brits in space, technically, Nick Fole and Pierce Sellers, but both became Americans to join NASA and go up on the space shuttle. But Tim Peake is the first. He's still British. I want to say he's paid for by the British government. He's not. He's kind of paid for by the British government.
I think you could say perfectly well that he is, because because we have recently started giving a few tens of millions of pounds to the European Space Agency's manned programme. So we're actually paying. He is the first official British astronaut.
Well, it's all very exciting. He's an army helicopter pilot in his early 40s. He's going to be inspiring generations of kids. Ian, the economic opportunities that something like this brings the UK are quite interesting, isn't it? Aren't they? Because Robin's talked a bit about the companies. What does the Britain's government see in this?
Well, I want to come back to something actually, and it's that you could argue Britain's actually done something quite interesting here, because for a long time the official UK policy has been not to fund human spaceflight, and the thinking has been it's there's something fairly trivial about it. It's there isn't much to be gained from it. Why do we send people into space? Is a question that goes back, you know, way beyond even the Apollo program. And so UK didn't put money into it. It said what we're going to do is we're going to build up industry. Now, what they do now is kind of the behind the scenes deal that no one ever talks about, because we're not sure quite how true it is. But this, the way it seems to have been, is that Tim Peake was selected after an agreement that the UK would put more money into ESA. And UK is now pretty much the third biggest contributor in that we put 240 million into European Space Agency. OK, but we put it into projects that aren't human spaceflight. There was a one-off payment into human spaceflight, but most of our money goes into other projects. And that money, according to David Willetts, our science minister, makes a return for British business of 1 to 4. So that means that we get £1 billion of orders back for the 240 million a year we put in, okay? So we're making good business on this. Now, what advantage do you get from having a spaceman, an astronaut? Well, there is this idea of prestige globally, but I'm not sure if everyone thinks, oh, you know, more highly of Canada or Italy or where have you because they have astronauts. But what it certainly has is an effect domestically in inspiring people to go into the space industry domestically. And I think that's what's of interest to the UK, where in the UK, the space industry has defied gravity, to use a horrible kind of related pun. But it's since 2007, space industry in the UK has grown by about 8% year on year. And find me another industry in the UK that's done that through the financial turmoil. If you can get more money, more people into that business, then the idea is the government wants to just really make the most of it.
Well, look at the idea of astronauts inspiring people. It's kind of always been there in the ether, but it became really true, of course, and obvious when the Canadian astronaut recently who came down from the International Space Station, Commander Chris Hadfield, was greeted with the sort of reception you've not seen since the astronauts who came down from Apollo. So we're talking, he's the man who's been tweeting pictures from space. Such a simple thing, occasionally talking to people directly from the International Space Station, which I still think is quite a cool thing to do. And he, you know, million followers on Twitter, and the man is hailed as a hero on primetime TV shows and all sorts of things. I mean, that's got to have some impact on what people, politicians, others think of space flight and space technology, and does more for that those industries than how many behind the scenes meetings you can get, because the politicians now know that it's a vote winner. Mm-hmm. They can see it as well as an industrial thing. The interesting thing is, of course, Tim Peake's got a couple more years of training to do. He's done three, and he's got a couple more years. Do we know what he's going to be doing up there?
No, I don't think we know. It's he's there for a long time, so there's a good chance he will do a spacewalk or something. He doesn't go up until the end of 2015. So it's not going to be a vote winner for this current government. It's going to be a vote winner for the next one, perhaps. What he does up there, he does the routine, you know, unblocks the toilet when it gets, when it gets jammed or something.
That's a metaphor, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
That's a metaphor for, he's going to be doing scientific experiments and as well as, you know, perhaps training for, you know, the spacewalks or EVAs as they're called. He's got quite a lot to learn still, I suppose. He's not been into space yet.
Well, what they do is now, I mean, you go up for selection after you've done your basic training. And for the basic training, I mean, he did some incredible stuff. I mean, he lived underground for a week with others in Sardinia to learn how to cope with, you know, environments like that, to work with the group, even to do things like learn how to do the photography in crazy light conditions and things. He spent 12 days underwater in an underwater lab off the coast of Florida. And there's an awful lot of sort of forest and jungle survival work and things like that. What happens now is he goes into training which is specific for the mission. And you're right, he's already, he's going to be eligible to do spacewalks. But he'll go as a flight engineer is the title he'll have on the mission. But his actual tasks are going to be nailed down over the time as what is necessary to be done on the ISS becomes apparent.
Imagine all that training, all that underwater training, all that jungle training, just to unblock toilets.
I know.
It seems like such a waste.
It's the British way, though.
It's the British way. He said in his press conference, of course, that in sort of following in Commander Hadfield's footsteps, he might play the didgeridoo up in space. He said that, and then I saw a tweet later that he was just doing that he wanted to get the word didgeridoo into the press conference.
Yeah, what he said was... he said, look, I anticipate your questions about whether I'm going to be doing a Hadfield, essentially. And he said, look, I do play the guitar very badly and I wouldn't impose my singing on anybody. But then he said later that a friend had promised to teach him how to play the didgeridoo. Now, the thing is, the guitar, and there's a keyboard as well, the guitar is already up on the space station. And the only stuff you're allowed to take in terms of like personal effects has to fit into a box the size of a shoebox. So unless he's got like a telescopic didgeridoo, it's not going to go anywhere.
A telescopic didgeridoo. Can you imagine?
Or are you just pleased to see me?
Yeah, well, he was given a bit of a monstering on Newsnight, I heard. I didn't see this myself, but apparently Jeremy Paxman, monstrer-in-chief on TV, gave him a bit of a hard time. What's the point of space? Why are you up going up there? Won't you get bored? But I heard he did very well. I mean, the man's trained to be calm in all situations.
Yes, so. he's a very polished chap. I mean, and he knows how to deal with the press already. I met him 2 years ago on a European Space Agency conference in Florida, and he knew how to handle the press easily. He's very accomplished, very very calm, as you would imagine. You can't imagine this guy ever being flustered.
Now, talking of that, I mean, we're going to have a bit of a giggle about the way this was announced. So last week, before this announcement was made, as far as I was aware, there was only one British astronaut. Yep. And then we all got a press note saying, next week, the British astronaut going to the space station will be revealed.
Yes.
And so...
Not even that.
It was the mission, and the man in the mission will be revealed, which was interesting because we only had one astronaut, Tim Peake.
We only have
one rocket, the Soyuz, and there's only one destination, the space station.
There were no other options, but you know, it's good news nonetheless, and deserves the coverage it gets given the things that do get coverage in our national media. I think it's not a bad thing at all. Can I ask you both just before we wind up, NASA? What's NASA's status now with astronauts, given that we don't really have a sort of a plan to replace the shuttle yet? I mean, there are ideas in there. Unfortunately, even the robotic probe seems to be going wrong. Kepler, the planet hunter, has disappeared after a sterling few years of effort, finding more than 2,000 planetary candidates. We've got a few years before we see another American mission proper into with that American astronauts.
Well, I mean, they're still thinking about what kind of capsule they're going to build for it, and there's the possible involvement of the European Space Agency, which of course would then create a capsule. This capsule would go beyond Earth orbit. This is something that might go to the moon and to asteroids, and Europe might well then have a say on one of the places on it, which then of course opens up the prospect in 10 years time, you know, Tim Peake is an experienced astronaut,
that'd be great,
and he gets a chance to go.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
Imagine a Briton or an astronaut. Go on.
This is a hugely interesting transition time though, and I think it's a really ugly time for the US, but it's a necessary transition they've got to go through. And what they've done, I think, is pretty bold in a way, because it's a gamble. What they're doing is they're saying, okay, private industry, you do Earth to low Earth orbit, and that's what we're seeing with SpaceX and things like that. Mm-hmm. And if those guys can make their rockets man-rated, as they call it, if they can make them safe enough for astronauts to travel on, that's going to work, and that's going to be a nice commercial private sector job. And then it'll allow NASA to focus on the more hairy stuff, of the more pushing the boundary stuff, of going as you say, beyond, back to the moon, maybe looking at asteroids and maybe focusing on this idea of going to Mars. Mm.
All right, well, we'll leave that there. Thanks very much, Ian and Robin. If you want to read more about Tim Peake or any other space stuff, go to guardian.co.uk/science. Have you ever wondered what all the ingredients are for the magic electronic world around you? We're speaking next to a man who can reveal all. Professor Andrea Sella is a chemist and Professor of Materials and Inorganic Chemistry at University College London. On Friday 31st of May, he'll present a lecture intriguingly titled Terra Rara, the strange story of some political elements. The discovery and use of rare earth metals, he'll say, are a window into some interesting geopolitics. Andrea, welcome. Tell me first, what are the rare earths and you know, where do we find them?
Well, the rare earths are a group of, depending on how you count them, about 14 elements, most of them located fairly low in the periodic table. And they're fairly widespread around the world, although they're called rare earths. In fact, most chemists will refer to them as the lanthanides, in other words, the elements that resemble lanthanum. These are 14 elements that, when they were first discovered, were extremely unusual. They'd only been found in Scandinavia, and people thought they must be very unusual, and so they got this funny name. And earth, of course, is really a sort of old-fashioned name for oxides. And so they're things that really behave a little bit like calcium, a little bit like barium, that sort of thing.
So where did you mention Scandinavia? Where did the first rare earth get discovered?
Well, the rare earths actually emerge in that heroic 18th century period of what Rutherford rather dismissingly called stamp collecting. You know, when people like Linnaeus are essentially looking at species of organisms and classifying them, and there are people running around, A, looking for new compounds and new elements, but there are also people looking for new rocks and trying to make sense using this kind of principle of taxonomy, of kind of classifying, of dividing, saying this is similar to that, so it must be related. And there's lots of amateur scientists out there who are really doing this kind of job. And one of them was a young army officer called Arrhenius, and he's no relation to the more famous Svante Arrhenius later on, the great chemist who explained how reactions go. He's a young officer, and he found a very, very dense rock somewhere near Stockholm in a place called Utterby. And this rock was very unusual. He couldn't fit it with anything that made sense. And so he contacted one of the great Swedish chemists of the time, who was actually across the Gulf of Bothnia over in what's now Finland, a man called Gadolin, and said, can you analyze this? And Gadolin analyzed it to death and eventually said, well, it's not anything that I've ever seen before. This must contain a new element. And so this element was called yttrium. And so that was, in a sense, the beginning of the story.
Why was it not yttrium?
Well, I think that's because in English we struggle with the fact that the Y in Swedish is pronounced U.
These elements turn up at the end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th, and onwards. But they're not used nowadays for structural things. They're not in buildings or airplanes or something. They're in as structural items. They're not that. They're almost like inflections, aren't they? And their particular chemical properties are help to create some of the really complex world around us. Give us a little rundown of the kinds of things these lanthanides are doing.
So the thing about the lanthanides or rare earths that really makes them incredibly individual is really the electrons within them. And the electrons are unusual in the case of the lanthanides because normally we think about the electrons that perform the chemistry and as being the outermost ones. Those are the ones which are most energetically accessible.
And this is a way of looking at chemistry. Electrons.
Well,
chemistry
is all about electrons, and what chemists do is essentially they obsess about where the electrons are. And the electrons, of course, are really the glue that holds our world together, right? They're the things, you know, when we think about bonding and you hear in school about covalent or ionic, what you're really doing is talking about where are the electrons? Are they associated with this atom, that atom? Are they shared between them? Now, the lanthanides are very, very unusual because on the one hand, some of their electrons they lose and transfer to other places, and so that gives them a charge, and so they stick to things of opposite charge. But they then have some leftover electrons, which are the things that really give each element its individuality. Now, the electrons give rise to, first of all, optical properties. When you shine light, what they tend to do is give very, very sharp peaks. And this is really important because it means that if you consider each one of these elements, each one will have a very, very characteristic signature, these sharp lines which are produced. And so there are tremendous glows that come out of these elements of different colors. So, for example, europium is quite famous for giving a beautiful kind of orange glow under the right circumstances. Cerium often emits in the blue. And to some extent, you can tune these things. But the second thing is that they also give rise to magnetic properties. And so the most spectacular of these is when you make an alloy which takes neodymium and iron, and the electrons associated with the neodymium are able to pin the electrons of the iron. And what they do is they make magnets which are about 1,000 times stronger than the sort of traditional sort of ferrite magnets that one used to use. And these are referred to as rare earth magnets. And they're the things that we now find in wind turbines, in electrical generators. You find them in the regenerative brakes of hybrid cars. You find them in these miniaturized motors, you know, all sorts of places, because they are so extraordinarily, magically strong.
So, and all these new technologies have been enabled by the fact that you can get some very, very strong magnets in very, very small volumes.
Absolutely. And so the current you need in order to generate the force is much smaller, or alternatively, the amount of motion you need to generate current is much greater. So these lanthanides suddenly confer on materials all kinds of really extraordinary properties. You have fantastic glows. You can store light in certain ways. You can generate magnetic fields. There's all sorts. There's a real plethora of new applications which have come out.
And one more example before we go on: erbium, which happens to shine a perfect light for optical fibers.
Well, erbium is incredibly important, and nobody's really heard of it. Again, the name erbium, you'll notice, it sounds like that place. Ytterbium, right, sort of ytterby, and the element names, many of them are named after this place. So erbium, it turns out, gives out light of 1.3 microns. And 1.3 microns, you know, what's the significance of that? Well, if you're trying to shine light down an optical fiber, and the optical fibers are what carries all the data. In fact, you know, as you listen to this podcast, you're listening probably through the medium of the internet. Those flashes of light, we normally assume that there must be visible light. But visible light isn't good because it gets scattered down the long length of cable. And so in the same way as light is attenuated when you look through the sky, and in fact the sky looks blue, that Rayleigh scattering actually attenuates the light as it travels down the fiber. So what you do is you change the wavelength. It turns out that the Rayleigh scattering depends very, very strongly. It depends as lambda to the power 4. The longer the wavelength, the further the light will travel. But if you go too long out into the infrared, then you start finding that bond vibrations will attenuate the... So there's a perfect kind of sweet spot where really the attenuation is at a minimum. 1.3 microns is perfect. And so erbium amplifiers and so on are the thing that really makes the internet fiber optic communications possible.
All of these things sound like they were made for the electronic age. But I mean, obviously the electronic age itself has only been around for, 30 or 40 years. But these things, the elements themselves have been around for a lot longer than that. Were they used for anything, or were they just curiosities before that?
They had no uses. I mean, you had first strange minerals. They were such rarities that they weren't really much good for anything. I think through the 19th century, people sort of looked at these things and wondered. And there's a wonderful quote, which I can't actually remember verbatim, from Sir William Crookes. He addressed the British Association in 1887. And he said that they stretch like an unknown sea before us, beckoning strange possibilities and revelations.
And so at what stage did we start to really get to a point where we could start to separate these things from that lump of ytterbium stuff at the beginning?
Well, it was a real problem, and the only tools they had were having a lot of beakers and then dissolving, and then carefully crystallizing, filtering, separating, and then doing it over and over again. And you would have tens
Sounds like
of thousands.
Work.
It was maddening, real drudgery. And it took some real obsessives to do this kind of work. And the separation of the lanthanides effectively is really a direct product of the Manhattan Project. And so you can think of the lanthanides as being the equivalent of, turning swords into plowshares. It was, a military project which actually ended up having incredible civilian spin-offs. And the question was, how could you do this process of distinguishing between two elements which have very, very similar chemistry and doing this thousands upon thousands of times? And the first method was what's called ion exchange chromatography. So you have a polymer, a resin, and it is studded with negative charges. And what you do is you take solutions of the mixture of your rare earths, and you have them as ions. So they're all 3+ ions. Now, the differences between these elements are the size. So you have the large ones, which have 3+, but they're big, and so they're rather kind of floppy. And then you have the small ones, where the positive charge is much more concentrated. That means that the small ones will stick to the resin a bit more than the big ones. And so as you run the solution down this column, what you'll find is that the big ones will start to come out first and the small ones will come out last. And so this gave a man called Frank Spedding, who worked at the Ames Lab in Iowa, really an efficient way of separating out the elements very, very quickly. And you could do it in a matter of hours rather than weeks. Now, from the point of view of the Manhattan Project, it was brilliant because now they could do the analysis of their fission products, of the products of explosions, and so on. But now, suddenly, you had available pure samples of these individual elements quite quickly, and you could start to look at their physics, their chemistry, and so on.
So the Manhattan Project was about making a nuclear bomb. And as you say, the results of that have spun out into very, very interesting things that we now use in electronics. And we talked about some of those already. But nowadays, it's an industry to get this stuff out. It seems like most of it's controlled by China, though. How did it end up over there? And do we not have any in the rest of the world? I mean, these aren't actually, despite their name, very rare in the Earth's crust.
Not at all. If you look across the world, you'll find that there are big deposits of rare earths in various places.
I mean, they're more common than the precious metals.
Absolutely. They're certainly more common than things like platinum, palladium, gold, and so on. But the difference is that gold, platinum, palladium have such individual chemistry, and they are found sort of individually in mineral deposits, that actually you've only got to separate them. I mean, the separation problem is relatively easy. What you find is that in deposits such as in California, in a romantically named place called Mountain Pass, or in the great sort of rare earth sands in India and in Mongolia, these things all come together. So you'll find 7 or 8 of these things all together, and they're mixed in with other stuff. So in addition to the rare earths, you'll also find that there are small amounts of thorium, little bits of uranium, and so on mixed in. And that means that when you start doing the mining and the purification, the tailings from the mines tend to be rather radioactive. And this is one of the reasons why the mine in the United States, which was the biggest in the world all the way through the sort of 50s, 60s, and 70s, right, was gradually closed down on environmental grounds, is that, there were pressure groups in California who said, you just can't be dumping all this radioactive junk all over the mountainsides. And so, because there were large deposits in China and it was cheap to operate there, all of the action shifted there. And the next thing is that the separation technology, which in fact they no longer use this ion exchange thing. They actually use a much more scalable technique, which is solvent extraction, where you can actually sort of separate the ions by extracting using kerosene and other stuff. It's quite a messy process, but you can scale it up hugely. All of that technology shifted to China and was, in a sense, kind of lost in the West. It wasn't forgotten, but because it was so much cheaper to do over there, it shifted to China. So China gradually became the the producer and purifier of well over 90% of the rare earths worldwide.
That's remarkable, given how important they are to the economies of the world.
Well, it's quite astonishing, and I think no one really paid any strategic attention and thought, well, wait a second, you know, what are the ramifications of transferring all of that sort of technology and so on to over there? Now, of course, one can set up a plant over here, but it does take time. And so what happened was that the Chinese gradually realized that they were sitting on a gold mine. There were all of these technologies in the West that, of course, you know, the Chinese, of course, are huge users of green technologies. They're bringing on wind turbines. They're you know, there's all kinds of stuff which is coming on. But they, of course, realized that simply to sell either mixed rare earths or to sell even the pure oxides, which are the starting material for all these technologies, wasn't actually very profitable.
I mean, it makes a lot of sense for China to sell electronics or products rather than the raw materials themselves. I mean, they can get much more money for that. I mean, in a way, is that why so many of our electronics companies from the West are based in China in terms of manufacturing?
Well, I think the labor costs and those kinds of things are probably even more important. But from the perspective of these elements, because they appear in small amounts in so many of our devices, whether they be, you know, those laser pointers and those kinds of things.
Touch screens.
You know, they appear in all kinds of things that glow or are magnetic or, you know, the other place where you find huge amounts of rare earth are in the actual honeycombs of our car exhaust catalysts. And the most common of the rare earths, cerium, you have this huge honeycomb of cerium dioxide, which is one of the things that scrubs pollutants out of the exhaust of every car. So in order to meet our air pollution requirements, we need cerium. And there's no other element that you're going to be able to swap in for that. So from the Chinese point of view, it's kind of a no-brainer. But looking at it in the other way, and that is from the West perspective, we're no longer seeing China as quite as benign, perhaps, as we used to. And they could conceivably put the squeeze on the West. So at the moment, the race is on. There are kind of new, improved processes, cleaner processes, more efficient processes, which are being developed by, for example, the American company Molycorp, which are the people who have that pass, that Mountain Pass mine in California. And they now have a new and improved process to be able to separate the rare earths. The sands which contain the monazite sands, monazite being one of the key minerals that contains the rare earths, are starting to be exploited around the world. And so over the next few years, what I think we will see is a gradual drop in China's sort of lead in this area. But it's going to take time. And in that period, there is a sense, I think, from some people, of vulnerability for the West. Because if just one element were suddenly shut down, they said, right, no more erbium, our ability to lay fiber optics, you know, around the globe and so on, suddenly grinds to a halt.
I suppose it's worth pointing out or realizing just for a moment, without getting frightened about these things, that we do depend on all this technology, I mean, almost invisibly, but 100%, even if you don't realize you need optical fibers, you personally probably don't. But the internet, as you said, runs entirely on these things, and all our communication systems run on optical fibers. Touch screens, as I mentioned before, with the indium underneath them, they wouldn't work without those things. I mean, so I'm hoping someone in power has realized these things, I'm assuming they have, and these different processes would come along. But can I ask you a little bit, just at the end, about, I mean, our need for these things are not going to go down. We're going to need these things more and more. But are there other newer elements or compounds or particular structures that we are producing that will mimic some of these things so that we don't rely so much on foreign nations? I mean, people always talk about graphene and the sort of that sort of future, which can mimic all these rare earth things. I mean, what's your thought on this?
I'm not sure that graphene is likely to be able to mimic, you know, all of the properties of these things. But it's absolutely clear that when you start playing around with chemistry and you start tinkering with different elements, one of the things that you're able to do is to get one element to behave rather like another one for a specific application. And so it's often possible, yes, to replace one thing with another, because over time we come up with methods which allow us to do that. So one place where there is huge amounts of kind of chemistry activity is in thinking about, for example, the noble metals. If you think about platinum and palladium and rhodium, and those are elements which are workhorses in the catalytic world. In other words, if you want to carry out reactions efficiently, you've got these kind of little molecular robots which help you to do those transformations at lower temperature, at lower cost, faster, with fewer side products. And one of the big growth areas in chemistry is actually finding really common or garden, cheap as chips kind of elements like iron or cobalt, which you can use in place of that. For the rare earths is actually much, much trickier, because being able to mimic those very, very specific magnetic and electronic properties is incredibly hard. And that's really driven by the quantum mechanics of the situation. And understanding the electronic structure of these metal ions is already fiendishly difficult. And this is something that I've been working with colleagues on for quite a while, is trying to understand how the electrons are actually arranged. And you need a combination not simply of quantum mechanics, but you've also got to add in relativity into your calculations. They're very, very complex systems. And the idea that you might simply be able to mimic them with something else, I think, is very, very optimistic. As chemists, though, I think hope springs eternal, because so many times we've been able to, sort of do a kind of copycat thing doing one set of chemistry and then finding another way to do it with another strategy. That's great. But when it comes to the physics, in a sense, the photophysics and the magnetism, I think that's a much harder problem.
But are there a new sort of generation of materials that you're excited about then in that case? I mean, or is it that we still have tons and tons of stuff to find out about the rare earths and what they can do?
There are astonishing rare earth-based materials. I mean, first of all, there are rare earth compounds which are coming out which are doing extraordinary chemistry. And one of the things is that they continue to break the rules that we learn as undergraduates. And I think that's a really important point. One of the reasons why the rare earths are so attractive is that they do actually, they're kind of bad boys in a way, because some of the rules that we learn about structure and bonding, when you get to the rare earths, a lot of those rules fall away. And so it's been for several years a kind of Wild West area where you uncover sort of new phenomena, new kinds of reactivity. But in terms of making materials, I think the sky remains the limit. There are all kinds of new applications, sort of faster devices, ways of getting light in and out, faster and better and more controlled fashion. And, there's huge amounts of activity. And when you then start to add in the possibility that you might tailor their size, that you might start to make particles of specific shapes, of specific dimensions and so on, then the whole nano thing actually makes the whole process even more interesting.
Andrea, thank you very much indeed.
It's been a pleasure.
If you're in London, Andrea's lecture takes place at the Royal Institution on Friday, 31st of May at 8 p.m. Find out more at rigb.org or click the link on our blog. That's all we have for you this week. Remember, there's nothing rare about breaking science news on our website, guardian.co.uk/science. Click liberally. But for now, from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.